Right, we're going to continue the Larger and Shorter Catechisms. We're talking now about the Ninth Commandment, questions 143 in the Larger, and question 76 in the Shorter Catechism. This is one of the cases where they both read the same. Which is the Ninth Commandment? The Ninth Commandment is, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. This commandment is right in the middle of what we talked about a few weeks ago. The last three commandments have to do with outward estate, and in particular, a kind of honesty with respect to that outward estate. If we ask the question, and we're going to, why is this the Ninth Commandment? We've been asking that all along. Why are they in this order? Well, the first thing we need to do is remember the warning of John the Baptist to the soldiers. And it will appear there that the second thing he mentions is deceit. Deceit is that second way in which men offend in things of this life, that outward estate. Look at Luke 3:14.
Luke 3, verse 14. And the soldiers likewise demanded of him, saying, and what shall we do? And he said unto them, do violence to no man, neither accuse any falsely, and be content with your wages.
Yeah, do violence to no man, accuse none falsely, and be content with your wages. That's an admonition to be careful in these last three commandments. Theft is a violent taking away of property. The Ninth Commandment has to do with a taking away of something, perhaps not in a direct way, but the violation of this command creates the atmosphere. It creates that kind of situation where all of these other acts of violence can occur, this active taking away. So after the concern of theft in the Ten Commandments, look at Exodus 20, verse 15,
thou shalt not steal.
It's logical, it's proper that there remains concern for faithfulness toward the outward estate of others. Look at Exodus 20:16.
Exodus 20:16. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor.
We're concerned here with an amount of faithfulness. Why are we concerned with that? Well, if there isn't a degree of faithfulness in a society, and we'll come back to this again and again actually in the next few weeks as we go over the Ninth Commandment, but without a sense of faithfulness, all trust deteriorates, decays in a society. In the case of theft, stealing, you have an outward assault. But bearing false witness is more subtle than that. It can be, as we'll see, open and just flat out lying about someone. But the fact is that it often involves more subtle encroachments on the outward estate of others. It often brings an assault to someone's outward estate or their good name and credit in a way that is indirect. And that's harder in some respects to counter. And when we get to the 10th commandment, we're really going to face what is in some respects the point at which we see these commandments, all of them, almost turn inside out and back again on themselves, because it becomes so subjective at one level that it's very hard to root out. It's even hard for us to root it out of ourselves. So, just as we're forbidden to exhibit a faithlessness with respect to the outward estate of the Lord, which is His name, if we look at Exodus 20, verse 7, and 2 Chronicles 6, 6.
Exodus 20, verse 7. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless to take this name in vain.
2 Chronicles 6, 6. But I have chosen Jerusalem that my name might be there, and have chosen David to be over my people Israel.
I've chosen Jerusalem that my name might be there. What is that? In the Bible, God's name is where we meet Him. There is, in fact, a point of connection between His name and our use of it. There is, in fact, a very direct connection between the third commandment against taking the Lord's name in vain and this ninth commandment, bearing false witness against our neighbor. The whole idea of witnessing connotes giving testimony, being under oath. And that, in fact, implies taking God's name in vain as well. God, for us, dwells there. He meets us there. There is a faithfulness that's required in the use of God's name. It is the sign of His dwelling. And that honesty that we need between one another is, in fact, a place where we meet one another. We meet one another at a point of fundamental honesty in any exchange. If there's not that point of fundamental honesty involved, it's very, very difficult for anyone to conceive of any approach. You've abused the other person. You can't make that approach. So if we've abused the name of God, we can't really approach unto Him. And this is it. If we're bearing false witness against our neighbor, it's hard to approach Him. And so this commandment then mirrors that concern in our neighbor. That is the third commandment. Look at Psalm 101, verse 7.
Psalm 101, verse 7. He that worketh deceit shall not dwell within my house. He that telleth lies shall not tarry in my sight.
Yeah, he that worketh deceit shall not dwell in my house, God says. And again, that's why? Well, God's house is where His name dwells. And if you're working deceit, you are, in fact, at an opposite point, a polar opposite to that faithfulness which God requires if you are going to, in fact, dwell with Him. Indeed, we're told in Scripture there's vanity attached to the use of deceit, to the prejudice of the outward estate of others. Look at Proverbs 21, 6.
Proverbs 21, verse 6. The getting of treasures by a lying tongue is a vanity tossed to and fro of them that seek death.
The getting of treasures by a lying tongue is vanity. Just like when we take the name of the Lord in vain, lying in order to trespass against our neighbor is, in fact, vanity. There's a vanity. We've taken their name, in a sense, in vain. That is, we've taken that point at which we would meet them in a position of trust and honesty, and we've thrown that out the window. We've destroyed that. There is no point at which we can meet. There can't really be an agreeable dwelling together. See, God's name dwells where we meet with Him, and we dwell together with Him in that. But we only do that in the truth. We don't do that when we're lying. We don't do that when there's faithlessness on our part. So we need to understand that this is why this is a ninth commandment. This is really a touchstone and a reflection. And we've seen this with all of these commands. They all, in a sense, are analogous to something that we witness in the first table of the law. They have, and they reflect that same idea. Love to God is the basis upon which our love to other men is, in fact, to be founded. And so it really should not surprise us to see that these commandments are linked. We're told, in fact, that if we break one law, we've broken them all. And if we ask why, well, again, think about it. If you bear false witness, you have not only violated this command, you've violated the third commandment. You've taken the Lord's name in vain. We either dwell together in Him or we dwell apart, because there is no other place where we can dwell. In Him we live and move and have our being. There's no other place to come together. Hell is going to be a place of separation. It will be the ultimate place of loneliness and gnashing of teeth in that respect. They're not going to be tormented together. People who think that hell is going to be a place of great company are going to be sorely disappointed, because there's no communion. Communion is only in the truth. When people begin to lie, when people bear false witness, they break down the possibility of genuine communion. So if we ask in the second place then, what is the scope of this commandment? We have to consider in general. Well, I've already alluded to this a little bit. This commandment does have some reference toward our neighbor's good name and credit. Look at Proverbs 22, verse 1.
Proverbs 22, verse 1. The good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold.
Yet, and we don't want to leave out this idea of good name and credit. This is going to come up when we talk about duties required and sins forbidden. But the fact is that these words, if we look at Deuteronomy 5:20 and look at the other publication of the Ten Commandments.
Deuteronomy 5, verse 20, neither shalt thou bear false witness against thy neighbor.
Yeah, these words, this idea of bearing false witness, those are words of civil courts. That's judicial talk. Bearing false witness. And that kind of talk is why this commandment should be understood as being an assault against someone's outward estate. In civil courts, it's more often questions of land and possession that are brought into the courtroom to be decided than it is of someone's good name. That's not to say that there aren't cases regarding slander or libel, and that is covered by this. But there are a lot more cases where, in a very indirect way, people are assaulted in their outward estate, in their property, in their goods. And so, in that case, you can see that a violation of this command is also a violation of the command we just talked about, thou shalt not steal. But that stealing, in this case, when this precedes it, is now compounded by a different kind of sin. A sin that in fact involves taking God's name in vain. A sin which entails the breaking down of all trust. You know, when you steal from someone outright, as uneasy as they may feel about that, they know for sure that whoever took that is a thief. And everyone around them is clear that whoever took that is a thief. When you take someone's property by deceit, by fraud, by deception, it's not always clear to people around. The other party may know. But you now have, in fact, conspired to make, and this is where I think you compound this idea of taking the Lord's name in vain. If you remember when we talked about that, it had to do with the providences of God as well. And what you do when you lie, when you use deceit and fraudulent means, you in fact take providence as a cloak and try to hide what you're doing. Right, so this is really, bearing false witness has to do with this judicial idea. Look at Exodus 23:1.
Exodus 23:1. Thou shalt not raise a false report. Put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness.
We're not to put our hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. And that language has to do with swearing of an oath. An oath, and then turning around and violating that oath by giving false witness. That idea that there's been a conspiracy, behind-the-back agreement, that there is some sort of pact to cause there to be a deceit or fraud perpetrated. Right, this ninth commandment, then, if we look at the general scope of it, would have us deal truly and sincerely in all things concerning our neighbor's goods, whether his outward estate and worldly riches or his name and credit. And that's what Jesus calls being faithful or faithfulness. Look at Matthew 25:21.
Matthew 25:21. His Lord said unto him, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord.
And when Jesus talks about faithfulness here, what he's referring to is this true dealing, this sincere dealing. There's been a demonstration of a fundamental honesty between the faithful servant and his master. There hasn't been an attempt at cloak and dagger maneuvers to sort of outwit the master and get the upper hand in some way. There's not been deceit or fraud perpetrated. There's been no attempt to run around and, you know, sort of get around the barrier that the master is perceived to be. Faithful servant is content to, in fact, work within the providence that has been presented. So we have to deal truly and sincerely in those things. That word faithfulness refers, in fact, to a truth and a constancy in all of our bargains and in all of our agreements. Whatever kind of bargain, whatever kind of agreement we're entering into, we need to exhibit that kind of faithfulness. It's not just a matter of personal integrity, but there is, in fact, there's a conveyance of that, a sense of that integrity, I think, that's involved in this commandment. You know, a lot of times, that you're dealing with an honest person. You may not always like everything about the person, but you know that you're dealing with an honest person. And people oftentimes feel more comfortable with that than if they have the sense that you're dishonest. It's a special note, this idea of faithfulness, of those who shall dwell in the tabernacle of the Lord. Look at Psalm 15:2.
Psalm 15, verse 2. He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh the truth in his heart.
Shall dwell in the tabernacle of the Lord. This word truth here, emet, that word in Hebrew means both faithfulness and truth. In Hebrew, the word actually admits both ideas. Now, there is a faithfulness in the truth, and there is always truth in faithfulness. It's reflexive. Look at Psalm 111, verses 7 and 8.
The works of his hands are verity and judgments. All his commandments are sure. They stand fast forever and ever and are done in truth and uprightness.
Yeah, they're done in verity, the same word, emet. Truth and uprightness. Truth, emet. That is to say, they're not only done in truth, but they're done faithfully. You're not worrying about whether or not there's some sort of deceit or fraud being perpetrated. There's no concern for that. There's no reason. That is, in fact, what Jesus is talking about when he talks about a faithful servant. And that's why this is so important, because a faithful servant is, in fact, a servant who is steeped in the truth, one who is, in fact, able to speak the truth that is in the heart, not simply from the heart, but the truth is in the heart. It's dwelling in you. That is to say, you are possessed of that truth, and you're not going to allow the providence of something shake your, not merely your understanding of the truth, but your willingness to go forward and convey that truth. A lot of times people are shaken by things that go on, and they want to keep back. And that's a violation. We're going to talk about that a little bit in a moment. All right. This idea of faithfulness and truth, then, that is commanded in this prohibition against bearing false witness, it's contrary to every kind, all kinds of falsehood. The truth and falsehood are also polar opposites. God is concerned about the truth at every level. And if we're not going to participate, if we're not going to, in fact, be forward in the cause of truth, then we're putting ourselves on the side of falsehood. And if we put ourselves on the side of falsehood, we are, in fact, making God our enemy. So even though this command comes in at number 9, and it is primarily referring to our neighbor, it does, as we'll see, have reference both to ourselves and to our God if we're in violation of this. We're going to have to give an account. Ultimately, we're called to tell the truth. Now, some of the kinds of falsehood that are prohibited by this command, one thing would be the use of any open untruth or lie. Look at Ephesians 4:25.
Ephesians 4:25. Wherefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another.
We're to put aside lying, and we're told, in fact, Paul says, to speak the truth every man to his neighbor, to one another. Be forward in the truth. Put away the lying. They can't dwell together. I mean, in men, because of the sin nature, they very often try to, but they can't. One will win out. And usually, if you're given to lying, the truth is what is at a loss at the end. Right? Lying, in fact, we're told, is, so far from being the work of God, it is a cursed work of the devil. And in fact, Jesus says, those who lie are likened unto him. Look at John 8:44.
John 8:44. You are of your father the devil, and the lusts of your father you will do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it.
He's a liar and the father of it. Where did lying come from? Well, Jesus says it came from the devil. He's the father of it. God is not a liar. He's the God of truth. That's not to say that the devil is the opposite of God. The devil is not the opposite of God. The devil is the absence of God. And that is a dangerous place for us to be. When we lie, we're driving out truth and putting in its place nothing. It's vanity. Vanity simply means it's nothingness. The truth is something. A lie is nothing. If you keep that in mind, you'll understand what some of these verses mean as we go through them in a few minutes. All right. Lies, however, by creating these voids in information, they do have an effect. They have an effect of warping and twisting, and in fact, in a number of ways, undermining what is true. Lies are like weapons of war aimed against others. Look at Jeremiah 9:3-5.
Jeremiah 9:3-5. And they bent their tongues like their bow for lies. But they are not valiant for the truth upon the earth, for they proceed from evil to evil, and they know me not, saith the Lord. Take ye heed, every one of his neighbor, and trust ye not in any brother. For every brother will utterly supplant, and every neighbor will walk with slanders. And they will deceive every one his neighbor, and will not speak the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies, and wearied themselves to commit iniquity.
So Jeremiah says that lies are weapons. You know, people think, what harm is there in lying? Prophet of God says it's a weapon. What is it? Well, it's actually like a cancer that eats away the truth. You know, it's not putting something in the place of the truth, it's destroying the truth as much as it can. It's putting nothing back in its place. It's a weapon. And like a weapon, it very often causes harm beyond the immediate thrust of the weapon. You know, you may not think that your arrow is going to do anything, but there is very often collateral damage. You know, when they use weapons of war, they don't always get what is the target. And that's part of the problem with lying. Because it's not the truth. Very often, not only does it hit and harm the intended target, but it ends up harming others as well. Through the use of lies, men are often brought to like bloody results, we're told. Look at Hosea 4:2.
Hosea 4:2. By swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break out and blood toucheth blood.
Okay, lying is one of the things that is listed as a cause of blood touching blood. That is, of a bloody result. Through deceit, through fraud. What happens? So people, when you deceive someone and they find out, the reaction is very often violent. People don't like it. You've destroyed fundamental trust. You have cast down and crushed, by your deceit, the possibility of society. Society thrives on truth. Society needs fundamental honesty. And when you can't be relied upon in that way, you have made yourself unfit for society. The result is often provocative. You shouldn't be surprised that people react the way they do when they find out. You know, even liars, when they've been lied to, tend to react poorly. There's something in that. They sense that they've lost a bit of society in that. They've lost something that they themselves want, because as human beings, naturally, we want that society. We are social. God has created us to be social. And so to lose that is a very deep and wounding disappointment. Yet that's exactly what happens when there's fraud and deceit and lying, open untruth or lies. Coming back in the second place, another kind of falsehood is in fact any fraud or deceit. Look at Psalm 10, verse 7.
Psalm 10, verse 7. His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and fraud. Under his tongue is mischief and vanity.
His mouth is full of cursing, deceit, and fraud. Under his tongue is cursing. Why? Because when you lie, when you deceive, when you engage in fraud, you're not blessing someone else, you're cursing them. You may not be doing it openly. You may not think of what you're doing as openly taking God's name in vain with respect to that person. But you are doing that in a backhanded way. You are pulling that rug out from under them, that rug of fundamental honesty required for society. You are assaulting their sense of well-being. You are taking away from them a certain amount of comfort that everyone wants in life. You're undermining all of that. Fraud and deceit are not things necessarily that people can see, but they are affected by it. They see the results of it. Right? Deceit is, in fact, a demonstration by the mouth of a lack of steadfastness in heart. Look at Psalm 5:9 and Psalm 55:21.
Psalm 5, verse 9. There is no faithfulness in their mouth. Their inward part is very wickedness. Their throat is an open sepulcher. They flatter with their tongue.
Psalm 55, verse 21. The words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but more was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet were they drawn swords.
Yeah, again, the psalmist gives us this idea that when there's fraud and there's deceit, there's not just cursing, but there's war in the heart of the person. You know, why does it provoke violence when people feel like they've been defrauded, when they realize that they've been deceived in some way? Why is it that there's this violent reaction? Because you know deep down inside that other person has in fact been harboring a spirit of war toward you. You know, because you do it to other people. And that spirit of war ultimately is the spirit of kill or be killed. It's nasty and brutish. So behind all of this, of course, is an attitude that shows that you are, in fact, wrongly related to that sixth commandment, right? Thou shalt not kill. You're steeped in it. You have this war spirit going on against whoever you're deceiving. You're at war with them. You haven't declared it, and that's where the deceit and fraud is. So they don't always know that they should be on guard. They don't always know until it's too late that they should be watchful. But you don't care about that. You don't care about that, and when they realize that that honesty, that fundamental honesty that they thought existed, has been ripped away, the reaction is very often violent. It's very often violent because it's force meeting force, whether you realize it and recognize it for what it is or not. There's a lack of steadfastness in the heart because, of course, a heart that is not steadfast in the truth is not steadfast. You can't be steadfast in a lie. Lies are wavering. Lies are like vapors that vanish. They're shadows. They're not real. They don't point to anything real. They don't harbor anything genuine. They're empty. It's vanity. There's nothingness there. There's no ground for being stable or steadfast. You can't possibly be. Because at the center of it all, you're empty. All right, fraud and deceit, these are things that are, in fact, fruit conceived in iniquity and brought forth to undermine the truth. Look at Psalm 7, verse 14.
Psalm 7, behold, he travaileth with iniquity and hath conceived mischief and brought forth falsehood.
This has all been conceived in iniquity, and it's bringing forth, that is, it's giving birth to falsehood, which is what? Falsehood is vanity. Now, this is like when the prophet talks about the woman who thinks she's travailing with child, and all that she does is brings forth wind. That's what's happening. There's this great tempest. There's this angst. There's the pain of travailing. And at the end, there's nothing to show for it. It's vanity. It's vanished. It's gone. Lies, falsehood, deceit, fraud. It's all vanity. All right, another kind of falsehood, third kind, is the use of slander or backbiting, which assails another's good name, often shrouded in secrecy and treachery. Look at James 3, 6 and 7, and Proverbs 10, verse 18.
James 3, verse 6 and 7, and the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. For every kind of beasts, and of birds, and of serpents, and of things in the sea, and of things in the sea is tamed, and hath been tamed of mankind.
Proverbs 10, verse 18. He that hideth hatred with lying lips, and he that uttereth a slander,
slander and backbiting, again, are forms of deceit. And you think you have an expectation that there is, in fact, a degree of society, that there is a common honesty being observed between the parties. But behind all of that is a secrecy that is hiding treachery. And Solomon says it's foolishness. Ultimately, it's vanity. It comes to nothing. It's steeped in nothingness. And so it's foolishness. And just like the fool has said in his heart, there is no God, people who harbor lies, people who engage in this kind of behavior are harboring untruths or falsehoods. They're using them to strike at someone behind their back. But it's vanity. Now, in addition to all of this, we need to address, when we talk about the general scope, lying, which is, in fact, telling of an untruth with intent to deceive. Lying, we need to understand, should not be justified in any case. Look at Proverbs 12:19.
Proverbs 12, verse 19. The lip of truth shall be established forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment.
A lying tongue is but for a moment. It's fleeting. Why? Again, it's established in vanity. There's nothing behind it. But when you tell the truth, you are in fact tied to what is eternal. Tying yourself, your heart, your tongue, your everything to what is eternal. It's important to be a true witness, not a false witness. There's an idea that floats around every once in a while about justifiable lies. And that's why we need to talk about this. Is it ever justifiable to lie? That is, as I say, telling an untruth with the intent to deceive. And a lot of people will bring up cases in the Bible. The most famous is the one I want to look at briefly here, and that is Rahab, who sent the spies out in another direction. Then she told the people who came to see her. She's often brought forward as a good example of someone who lied and it was justifiable. In fact, she's probably the one most brought forward in this cause. Right? God's approving of Rahab, though, we need to understand that when he approves her in hiding of the spies, his approval of her is not based upon her lie. How could it be? What did we just read that Solomon said? Lying lips are but for a moment. God doesn't approve her because she lies. God approves of what she did because she did it, we're told, in faith. And though her faith was weak and attended with sin, in spite of her lie, which is her sin and weakness, we're told that God approved her faith. And that that work that she did was the work of genuine faith. That's the only point of this verse. Look at James 2:25.
James 2:25. Likewise, also was not Rahab the harlot justified by works, when she had received the messengers and had sent them out another way?
Yeah, we don't derive from this, we should not derive from this, the idea that there is a justifiable lie. Now, another thing that we need to be very careful about when we're talking about this is irony. Does this command condemn irony? And irony is a type of speaking where we use language which is literally untrue in order to convey something which is true. Are we allowed to do that? Are we allowed to be sarcastic? Does this command forbid that sort of thing? And the fact is, this command is not condemning irony. It's not condemning that kind of sarcasm, that is, especially when it's designed to correct, when it's designed to improve someone's understanding, when it's designed, in fact, to drive people to the truth. You know, in a way of irony, sometimes we say things which are so obviously untrue or in a sarcastic way, that people are brought to a point where they say, aha, that can't possibly be true. That's right. You know, my comment to people when they talk about if we didn't have a welfare state, what would happen to all of the poor people? And I say to them, well, we'll do with them what we used to, which is we put them out in the streets and watch them all starve to death. And people say, well, I don't think that ever happened. And of course, the answer is, of course not. It didn't happen. That's what we're talking about. Can we do that? And I would say, yes, we are allowed to do that as long as, I said, the design is this, to be correctly understood and without any deception. Look at 1 Kings 18:27.
1 Kings 18, verse 27. And it came to pass at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is talking, or he is pursuing, or he is in a journey, or peradventure he sleepeth and must be awakened.
Does Elijah really think that the god or the gods, that Baal is even a god? He doesn't think God, that Baal is a god. I mean, at the most, he thinks Baal is a demon. But does he think even any kind of spirit being, even if he's a demon, that he's doing all of those things? He's on a journey. He's doing other things. He's doing this. He's doing that. Maybe he's sleeping. That's not the point of him saying that. The point of him saying that to these priests and prophets of Baal is so that some of them perhaps would say, wait a minute, what kind of God would be worthy of my attention if he's no different than me? So I don't think that this command is condemning irony. Finally, I want to just note here in the general scope, it should be borne in mind this command holds forth virtue profitable to ourselves as well as our neighbors. The reason is because truth is a virtue whereby we're brought to know what is true and to utter things known as they are. Look at Proverbs 12, 17.
Proverbs 12, verse 17. He that speaketh truth showeth forth righteousness, but a false witness deceit.
He who speaketh truth showeth forth righteousness. You know, when we speak the truth, when we in fact engage this commandment, yes, we've spent a bit of time now talking about the benefit to our neighbor and the estate of our neighbor, but it's not just about your neighbor. Speaking the truth has an effect on you. It shows forth righteousness. That is to say, it establishes in you that connection with the truth which is necessary for you to be steadfast. Why is it true that the church historically has catechized before you even know what it is you're saying or thinking about? To learn how to speak the truth, to learn how to use words which are conformed to the truth, instills in you a certain steadfastness. There's that story, and I usually tell it when I start going through the Westminster Confession. The story about someone during the American Civil War who noted that shorter catechism men died better on the battlefield than anybody else. Why is that? Well, they learned how to speak correctly. They had the root of the matter in them. They had a handle on the truth. They weren't dying in a lie. They knew something true and real. It was substantial. And it was able to bear them up in the most important time of their lives, which is their death. And that's what this does. That's why this is so important. You know, the truth, when you lie, you're not simply hurting the other person. You may not perceive the harm you're doing to yourself, but you need to understand that what you're doing is you're making yourself an empty person. You're making yourself, in fact, unstable. There's no core to your being. You know, when we talk about people who have no moral compass, we use that term to describe people who, in fact, don't have a grasp of the truth. And that's what lying does. It makes you lose a sense of direction, moral direction. You know, this idea of speaking the truth from your heart is your tongue showing forth righteousness, your mouth showing forth righteousness, is correct. It's a correct notion. You should be very concerned that you have that kind of moral character, that kind of core is at work in your life. Without it, there's not going to be stability. There can't be. There's nothing to come back to if you're just full of lies. All right, the third question that we really should discuss is what special virtues are to be studied in regard to this command. When we talk about not bearing false witness, in order to follow through with the scope of what we've been talking about, there are, in fact, at least two virtues I want to talk about briefly, that are necessary to carry you through. Right? The two virtues that are particularly, I think, in view with regard to the keeping of this command are prudence and simplicity. And I say that because these are, in fact, two virtues which Christ himself requires mixed in all of those who belong to him. Look at Matthew 10:16.
Matthew 10:16. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves.
He says, be wise as serpents. That is to be prudent and to be harmless or simple as doves. And this same mixture is, in fact, the mixture of virtues that the Apostle Paul expects in the Romans. If we look at Romans 16:19.
For your obedience has come abroad unto all men. I am glad, therefore, in your behalf. But yet I would have you wise unto that which is good and simple concerning evil.
Yeah, wise unto that which is good and simple, or harmless, to that which is evil. Prudence and simplicity. What are they exactly? Well, prudence, and this is important because this is going to come up in some other things we talking about, hopefully in the near future. Prudence is a virtue to discern and judge of things aright. So the ability, prudence is really that virtue whereby we attain by searching out things which it behooves us to know. Look at Job 29:16.
Job 29:16. I was a father to the poor, and the cause which I knew not, I searched out.
The cause which I knew not, I searched out. Prudence is, in fact, concerned with, it's a virtue that you're concerned with discerning things aright in order to judge them aright. If you're to be wise as serpents in the world and harmless as doves, if you're to be wise concerning that which is good, but simple concerning that which is evil, prudence is that kind of wisdom. It's that desire, that virtue that some people have that pushes them not simply to assume that they understand, not simply to move forward regardless of what's right and wrong. People who are prudent generally don't run around saying things like this: my country, right or wrong. Prudent people don't say those kinds of things. It's not prudent to jump on board regardless of whether or not something is right or wrong. You need to discern, you need to judge aright. And the opposite of that, when people don't take that kind of care, we see that kind of opposite attitude condemned in the judges and rulers of the earth in Psalm 82:5.
Psalm 82:5. They know not, neither will they understand. They walk on in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are out of course.
Yeah, they know not. And they don't, they just walk on in darkness. There's no concern to discern. They don't care whether or not they're judging aright. They're not trying to see into a thing to see if it, what it is and what would be right. They just want to move on. And when people who are in positions of power and trust behave that way, the psalmist says all of the courses, the foundations of the earth are out of level, essentially. The foundation has been made ineffectual. Now, the whole point of a foundation is that you can build upon it. But when there isn't this kind of fundamental equity that can only come through prudence, you can't build the superstructure. So that doesn't simply apply in matters of state. It applies throughout life. When God condemns something in the greater, you should understand that he's condemning it in the lesser as well. If it's wrong in the judge or the magistrate, it's wrong in you. We need to try to discern and judge things aright. Simplicity. Simplicity is another virtue necessary here. It's the virtue of dealing sincerely in the things that we discern and judge of. Look at Zechariah 8:16.
Zechariah 8:16. These are the things that ye shall do. Speak ye every man the truth to his neighbor, execute the judgment of truth and peace in your gates.
When we discern and judge aright of a matter, which is prudence, simplicity is, in fact, that virtue of dealing sincerely with that piece of information, that truth. You know, it may not always be the easiest thing to do. It may not be what you want to do. It may, in some respect, cause you major inconvenience or worse. But you have to have that. All right, the opposite, the contrary of that is, first of all, when every unjust sentence, whereby sound judgment is corrupted into perverse dealing. Look at Amos 5, 6, and 7.
Amos 5, verse 6 and 7. Seek the Lord, and ye shall live, lest ye break out like fire in the house of Joseph and devour it, and there be none to quench it in Bethel. Ye who turn judgment to wormwood and leave off righteousness in the earth.
When you have discerned and judged aright, if you, in fact, would turn around and then pass an unjust sentence, it's false dealing. You are a false witness. You're sentencing contrary to what you know to be true. You've turned judgment, Amos says, into wormwood. You've made it bitter. The point of justice is, in fact, to set the world aright. You know, when there's a sense of justice prevailing, people tend to respond well to that. They know that there's been justice. But people also know when you've not been just in dealing with them, when there's been an unjust sentence. And it's bad enough when that happens by mistake, but it's a violation of the Ninth Commandment when you pass an unjust sentence contrary to a proper discernment and judgment. Right, the second way in which simplicity is undermined is in the giving of sentence for reward or bribery. Look at Isaiah 1:23.
Isaiah 1, verse 23. The princes are rebellious, and companions of thieves. Everyone loveth gifts and followeth after rewards. They judge not fatherless, neither doth the cause of the widow come unto them.
This commandment requires you not only to be prudent, that is to search out the cause, to reach into a matter and see it for what it is accurately. But once you have that information, you have to do what's right with it. And you can't pervert that. You can't turn that inside out. If you're rendering an unjust sentence, you know, contrary to what you know, that's a violation of this command. It's compounded, in fact, when you do the same thing, that is, render an unjust sentence, and you do it for reward. You allow yourself to be bribed in some way. You have some private gain. You've betrayed the principle. And you're doing it against prudence. You may have had prudence, but you don't have that simplicity. That is, in fact, the difference between simply holding the principle aright and putting the principle, that right principle, into action. You need to be prudent, but you also need to be simple enough to put it into action, to move forward. There are a lot of people who can't do that. Remember when Paul is in Acts, he's talking and Agrippa says, you know, almost you've persuaded me. That's his prudence. I mean, his prudence is telling him, this is right. This guy's telling me the truth. He's discerning the matter for what it is. He's seeing into the thing itself. He's judging aright of the seriousness of it. What does he say? Go, you know, he sends him away. I'll hear you another time. Paul gets that a couple of times, that attitude. Go away, I'll hear you another time. They're prudent men, but they're not possessed of this simplicity that we're talking about. The sentence that they pass in the end, again and again, and you look at the end, the last few chapters in Acts, this happens to Paul several times. The prudence without simplicity is not going to carry you with regard to this commandment. They have to be joined together. And that's why Jesus joins them together. It's why he commands and commends the joining of these things in believers. It's not enough to understand the principle. You have to put it into practice. If you don't, there's a violation of this commandment. All right, the fourth question, wherein is the evil of lying displayed. Well, we already talked about, you know, it's lie was created by the devil, if you will, though it's not really a creation, right? Because it's sin, and sin doesn't have any positive existence. It's vanity. There's nothing behind it. Well, the evil of lying, we can say, appears in several things. The first is this. It is a perversion of the power of speech. Look at Romans 15, verse 6.
Romans 15, verse 6. They may with one mind and one mouth glorify God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ.
We were given the capacity to speak in order to glorify God. Not to lie. Not to bear false witness. Not to seek to undermine the truth, but in fact to put forth the truth. When you lie, you are in fact perverting the whole reason that speech was given to man. Men were given the capacity to speak not only to glorify God, but so that they could have this society, this communion, this intercommunion in a closer and more intimate way than any of the animals. It's a power to put forth rational thought, meaningful ideas. And yet when you're consumed with and when you put forth lies, you undermine all of that. If somebody writes a book full of lies, it really is worth nothing. There's nothing there. It's vanity. If I write a book about some place that doesn't really exist, and I can talk about it all I like as if it exists, but it serves no end. It's vanity. It's going to vanish. There's nothing, there's no truth behind it. That's a perversion of this whole idea of why God gave us the power of speech. In fact, the second reason we see it's evil is it is, in fact, an actual opposition to the God of truth. Look at James 3:14.
James 3, verse 14. But if ye have bitter envyings and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth.
Yeah, lie not against the truth. God is a God of truth. He's given us this capacity to communicate for his glory, but if we turn it into the capacity to lie, to engage in falsehood, we're not simply failing to fulfill what it is, the reason for which we've been given that faculty of speech. But we are also engaging ourselves in a war against God because he's a God of all truth. Remember, lies are like weapons. And ultimately, the weapons are trained at God because he is truth. Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. You lie. Lying is a verbal slap at your Savior. Number three, it is irreverence to God, who is witness and judge. Look at Ecclesiastes 5:2 and 1 Thessalonians 4:6.
Ecclesiastes 5:2, be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, and thou upon the earth. Therefore let thy words be few.
1 Thessalonians 4, verse 6, that no man go beyond and defraud his brother in any manner, because that the Lord is the avenger of all such, as we also have forewarned you and testified.
What is it we should be worried about here? Well, This is what I talked about at the very beginning. This command is intimately tied to that third command. And so every lie, every bearing a false witness is in fact an irreverence offered to God. It's not just, you know, yes, there's open war in the lie itself, but there's another degree of irreverence, a total casting off of all regard. For God is a witness and he's a judge who is going to bring to you to account, everyone to account, for every idle word that's been spoken. You will give an account. He's the God of truth. He's got to get it all back together. He will get it all back together on Judgment Day. The truth is going to win out. It's going to be victorious because there's nothing behind the lie. But all the rumors, all the lies, everything stops on Judgment Day. And when you lie, you're forgetting that. You're forgetting, and that's an irreverence that you're offering to God. All right, fourth, it destroys confidence in society. Look at Leviticus 19:11.
Leviticus 19:11. You shall not steal, neither do you deal falsely, neither lie one to another.
Neither lie one to another. And I've been talking about this the whole time, that you're destroying confidence in society. You know, they used to call people who dealt fraudulently or were deceiving people, they called them confidence men. Now, the short for that is con man. But what you're doing is you're creating a false sense of confidence in the other person. And you rip it away. Well, you're not just destroying confidence in that person in the society between yourself and that other person. But that tends to have a ripple effect. People tend to trust other people less having been engaged in that way by you. So you're not just destroying a confidence in society that is at a very personal level, but you are in fact breaking down all confidence in all of society every time you do that. Right? Fifth, the evil of lying appears in that it is usually injury and injustice to our fellow men. Look at James 3:9.
James 3:9. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God.
Yeah, this is going back to some of the other things that I've mentioned along the way. But it is, in fact, usually when there is a lie, properly speaking, a deceit intended to, in fact, perpetrate some kind of fraud. When that lie goes forth, there's usually some sort of injury. There's some kind of injustice that we're going to do to someone else. You're not dealing with the person in a proper way. You're not blessing them. You're cursing them. You bless God with your mouth and you curse men with your mouth. You know, James is pointing out this is part of that whole scheme. You can't say you keep the commandment in all points but one. If you're breaking it in one, you're breaking it in all. You may think that you're not taking God's name in vain, is what he's saying, but when you curse men, when you break this commandment, you're taking God's name in vain too. You may think that you can do both, but you can't. The duplicity, the deceit ultimately is with you. You think you haven't done anything against the first table of the law. You've isolated this and minimized it. And James is saying you can't do that. It's real injury when you're cursing someone. You're stealing from them. You're trying to kill them. No, curse is just calling down the wrath of God upon someone. It's taking God's name in vain. But that's what you're doing when you lie to someone. That's what you're doing when you take it upon yourself to try to deceive someone. Right, the sixth way we see the evil is it is the effect of the lack of brotherly love. Look at 1 Corinthians 13:6.
1 Corinthians 13:6, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth.
Yeah, Paul basically is saying, look, we wouldn't even need to have this talk about lying if you had charity. Because charity does not rejoice in iniquity, it rejoices in the truth. Lying is palpable evidence you lack charity. And Paul says if you lack charity, you're in trouble. So don't think that it's something little or small. It still made the top 10. And the last thing that I want to deal with in the general view of this command is this. Must we speak all the truth all the time? Well, we're told that in the Bible that we don't need to speak all the truth all the time. If discretion, we're told, keeps the key of the door of our lips, we will not be like those who cannot rest until all the truth that is in us is out of us. Look at
Proverbs 14:33. Wisdom resteth in the heart of him that hath understanding, but that which is in the midst of fools is made known.
You don't have to say everything. Yes, it may be the truth. There are reasons, however, not to speak all the truth all the time. Prudence often dictates that some things be kept from view. Look at Proverbs 12:23.
Proverbs 12:23. A prudent man concealeth knowledge, but the heart of fools proclaimeth foolishness.
Prudent man concealeth knowledge. Remember, in order to keep this command, we have to have prudence and simplicity. We need to discern aright. You know, it's not always the correct thing to do to speak the truth in every situation. There are a number of reasons for that. Probably one of the biggest is if speaking the truth would tend to the harm of ourselves or our neighbors unjustly. Look at Proverbs 17:9.
Proverbs 17:9. He that covereth the transgression seeketh love. He that repeateth the matter separateth very friends.
Yeah, it's in this end that the words of Doeg the Edomite stand condemned for the unjust bloodshed they wrought. Look at 1 Samuel 22:22.
And David said unto Abiathar, I knew at that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's house.
Yeah, let's just run this thought experiment for a minute. Did Doeg lie? Was David and his men, were they there that day with Abiathar? Yes. They were all there. Did Doeg know that when he told Saul this, it was going to lead to the death of a lot of people? He knew it wasn't going to go well. If he had prudence, should he have known what was right? Yes, he should have. He should have known that they did nothing worthy of death. That they had done nothing worthy of the king's wrath. But wait, didn't he tell the truth? They were there. Sure he did. And in the course of telling the truth, he brought about the deaths of a lot of people unnecessarily. Right? We must never, even though we don't have to speak all the truth all the time, we have to be very careful that we never speak anything but the truth. Look at 2 Corinthians 13:8.
2 Corinthians 13:8, we can do nothing against the truth, but for the truth.
We are to be numbered among those who can do nothing against the truth, but for the truth. And that's precisely what's at issue with this question. Is it possible for us, in speaking the truth, to do something against the truth? And I think, and a lot of casuists think, that the answer is yes. You can. You don't need to tell all the truth all the time, especially when it involves unjust harm, either to yourself or to someone else. Again, we should, with Pilate, ask, what is truth? But we must stay for the answer. Look at John 18:38.
John 18, verse 38. Pilate saith unto him, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again unto the Jews, and saith unto them, I find in him no fault at all.
Yeah, what is truth? And then he walks away. We need to be very, very careful that we don't do that. You know, sometimes that's what we actually do when we speak all the truth all the time. We walk away in the midst of it. The whole point is this: it is the mark of the righteous that they study to answer. Look at Proverbs 15:28.
Proverbs 15:28. The heart of the righteous studieth to answer, but the mouth of the wicked poureth out evil things.
The mouth of the wicked poureth out evil things. The heart of the righteous studieth to answer. It's a mark of righteousness. You know, we need to not only seek to discern, but we need to be patient enough to hang around and judge aright. And then we need to have that simplicity to make another judgment. And that is what to do with that. If we're going to speak the truth, it has to be the truth. If it involves harm to the innocent, then the judgment may mean not speaking at that time. Right? We have to remember truth consists in a double harmony. The first is, it consists in the harmony of the tongue with the heart. Let's look at Psalm 15:2 again.
Psalm 15, verse 2. He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh the truth in his heart.
He that speaketh the truth in his heart. There's got to be a harmony between what's in your heart and what's on the end of your tongue. A tongue must be a faithful interpreter of the heart for there to be truth. Otherwise, the Bible calls that a false tongue. Look at Psalm 120, verse 3.
Psalm 120, verse 3. What shall be given unto thee, or what shall be done unto thee, thou false tongue?
God is very displeased when we take his name in vain, when we speak his praise, not from a heart principle, but simply from a principle of convenience or convention. But God would have us speak, he would have our tongues interpreting our hearts, and that principle ought to hold not only with respect to God, but with respect to our fellow man. We should, before we are going to speak the truth, make sure that, in fact, we believe it. The second harmony then has to be a harmony of the tongue with the thing itself, that is, with the truth itself. Look at John 8:32.
John 8, verse 32. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
Shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. There needs to be that testing. You need to know the truth. The truth itself. I know John is talking about Christ, but he's also talking about the whole concept of truth here. That Christ ultimately is the truth. And all truth is in fact gathered together in him. So if you're going to speak the truth, it not only needs to be from the heart, it also needs to be from the truth. And the reason for that, and this is the last thing I want to mention on this, is our misapprehensions of the truth do not change the character of laws. Look at 2 Thessalonians 2:11.
2 Thessalonians 2, verse 11. And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie.
It doesn't matter whether or not you think that a lie is the truth. This is why you need to be in touch with the truth. Your believing a lie is the truth does not make the lie true. Don't confuse the two. Right, next time we want to discuss, go over the duties which are required in this. And I've started to touch on some of that, but we'll get into specific duties. And then, Lord willing, the following week we'll talk about the sins which are, in fact, forbidden.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.